The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on Governor Christianen's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. As we've mentioned, today's meeting is also being recorded. Should you be a speaking participant and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Office, Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will facilitate today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need to establish. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us in the room, and we'll do that by this roll call. By example, I am Jerry Little, director of the Gopher in Gopher's office at 1 Eagle Square in Concord. With me are Joe Dorian, Rhonda Hensley, Wendy Gilman, Kate Finan. President Donna Susi, are you with us?
Yeah. I am, and I am at home in Manchester, and I am alone.
Thank you. Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Yes, I'm here. I'm at my residence in Pennacook, and I am alone.
Leader Chuck Morse.
Yes, I'm in my office in Atkinson, and I am alone.
Leader Dick Hinch.
Dick Hinch here. I'm in my office in Irma, and I am alone.
Chairman Lou D'Alessandro.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm in my kitchen in Manchester, and I'm alone.
Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
Hi, this is Mary Jane Wallner. I'm at my home in Concord, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan, I'm in my office alone.
And Representative Erin Hennessy.
Erin Hennessy, I'm in my home in Littleton with my two minor children.
Thank you all. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by a roll call following the process we just used. And finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to use 5-star if you would like to ask a question. Also, presenters are asked to hit 5-star when their turn comes up, as that allows us to unmute your line. Are there any questions before we begin today's scheduled presentations? We don't see any on the board, and I hear none, so we will move right into today's presentations, which focus primarily on healthcare. Our first presentation today is from Jay Klucher, Executive Director, Seacoast Mental Health Center, and President of the Community Behavioral Mental Health Association. And I believe Mr. Klucher also may have Mr. Richard Lamp with him, Executive Director. Are you with us, gentlemen?
This is Jay Klucher.
Thank you, Jay.
And this is Roland Lammy from the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association. First name is Roland, R-O-L-A-N-D. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Would you begin your presentation?
Certainly. Again, I'm Jay Klucher. I'm CEO of Seacoast Mental Health Center and president of the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association. I am located here in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And want to thank the committee for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. The 10 community mental health centers are essential providers, creating a statewide delivery system for mental health services, employing more than 2,500 individuals across all 10 centers. The community mental health centers did not close when the pandemic began. We have not closed. But like other organizations, we've lost some staff to mandated isolation due to travel, illness, COVID-19 exposure, or staff who've needed to take time off to care for young children who are out of school or out of daycare at this point in time. We have transitioned as many of our services as possible to telehealth and have greatly appreciated the increased flexibility to do that. But we are still needing to provide direct in-person care in our 24/7 residential group homes, in our assertive community treatment teams that work throughout the state, our mobile crisis units that are located in two regions in the state, and an inpatient unit in one region in Manchester. We have 24/7 emergency services statewide. We're still doing involuntary emergency admissions. We are still doing conditional discharge revocations, and we're still doing intakes for new patients who are entering into services throughout the state. We are seeing that individuals who would not generally require our services, especially children and adolescents, have an increased need for mental health supports at this time. This has been made more difficult because centers had been providing services in the schools throughout the state and now are trying to work with school districts and the youth and families individually so that they understand that they can still access care during this time. But it has definitely created additional challenges for outreach. We also see greater risk in the older adult population who are dealing with increased isolation and physical health issues in addition to the anxiety and stress related to being isolated for the pandemic. And a third population that we think is going to be exhibiting ongoing increased need is the healthcare community, that these are the frontline providers who, despite their own stress, anxiety, and family situations, are still showing up every day to provide services to people who are at risk of or testing positive for COVID-19. The mental health centers have ramped up our social media presence so that we can provide both education and support to the broader community and remind them all of our services that existed prior to this pandemic and the new things that we're trying to do to meet the needs that are out there. Our tagline, like many other providers on the front lines, really is, we're here for you. We provide services and supports that help individuals remain in the community rather than in an inpatient environment. When you can get services at the right time, it's not only more cost-effective, but it's more clinically effective. The centers have been nimble in the speedy transition to telehealth services, which we had to do within a week. But diminished revenues will not be sustainable without reductions in force and access to care in the mid to longer term. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Roland Lammy, who's going to review some of the data that the association has been collecting with respect to the financial impacts to the community mental health centers.
Great. Thank you, Jay. And Jerry, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to spend a few minutes with this legislative advisory board to provide some important information regarding the relief and recovery efforts amid this crisis. As I stated earlier, my name is Roland Lammy. I'm the executive director of the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association, and that's the association, as Jay referenced, that represents the state's 10 designated community mental health centers. Before I begin, I think it's important to note that my brief discussion with you will focus on the specifics of the 10 community mental health centers and their needs during this crisis. But that said, I think we can all say there is a growing need for mental health services support, and independent practice providers and substance use providers should also be considered in these recovery efforts. But the information I'm about to present isn't intended to minimize those needs. It's just that I have data that I collected specifically from our 10 Community Mental Health Center Association members and their administrative leadership. As many of you know, each of our 10 mental health centers are primarily funded by state and federal Medicaid revenue. On average, around 80% of a center's revenue is Medicaid funding. Some are higher, some are lower. And at the onset of Medicaid managed care, we created and negotiated a unique First in the Nation alternative payment model that provides a per member per month revenue stream. And that revenue stream is paid prospectively to the centers on a monthly basis by all three Medicaid managed care organizations. The model is complicated, so I won't get deep into it, but this payment model has certain caveats. It's including the need to meet certain production levels in the delivery of services to ensure that community needs are met. The fact is, though, that that's really hard to do amid this pandemic. I'm happy to say that through the collaboration with the three managed care organizations, along with the Department of Health and Human Services and the Governor's Office, we've been able to negotiate some relief from those productivity standards until the end of this fiscal year so that we can maintain a consistent per member per month revenue stream that was negotiated prior to the pandemic. So this revenue stream accounts for about 75% of the Medicaid revenue stream to any given community mental health center. While we think we may need additional relief on the model as we get into the next fiscal year and return to some normal routine, right now that aspect of our funding is okay and it's working. But as Jay mentioned, there's an ongoing dilemma in the other aspects of our business. The remaining problem comes in two broad areas. First, it's the inability to see patients in normal state that has shown a dramatic decline in the portion of our revenue stream driven in fee for services. Those include things like Medicare lines of business, 25% of the spending in the Medicaid line of business, commercial revenue, and self-pay revenue. And the second area impacting the mental health centers that I'll talk about is the cost equation, the things that they've had to invest in to continue to deliver value in our communities and provide important services to those with mental health needs. So let me start with the revenue shortfall. Last week, I worked with the chief financial officers of the 10 mental health centers to aggregate the fee-for-service revenue impact that's occurred during this crisis. Our analysis excluded the revenue that we have from that alternative payment model that I just referenced. And what we did is we tracked our weekly revenue dating back to January 1st. And what you see in the first full month from the March to April timeframe, the first full 30 days since the emergency order was issued, is a system-wide decline of a little over $2.9 million, basically a $3 million system-wide reduction in revenue per month across all 10 centers. These declines are net of one-time Medicare stimulus money. We collected about $338,000 across the system in Medicare stimulus money. So about a $3 million per month drop in revenue, primarily in Medicaid and commercial spending, where that makes up about 72% of the fee-for-service revenue in those two lines of business. So if we assume, you know, reopening in the next few months, we still believe that it's going to take centers time to get back up to speed in a normal working environment. And we think that, you know, if it's a couple of months, it's probably going to be a six-month window from now before normal state is being able to be achieved. So that's, you know, roughly in lost revenue, about $18 million across the system of 10 centers. On the cost side of this pandemic, community mental health centers have made investments in new technology, as Jay mentioned, stood up necessary telehealth capacity and moved and adapted to care, adapted its care model for its most fragile population at an amazing rate. Really, this system should be recognized for its ability to adapt during this crisis. But that hasn't come without significant costs. Many of our costs are one-time costs, like technology, but there are many ongoing costs that will also play out over the next 6 months at a minimum and tie to our loss of revenue in some ways. So ongoing costs of personal protective equipment are likely to be with us for some time. We spent just under $1 million in technology and personal protective equipment costs over the most recent span of time since the emergency order. Additionally, our mental health centers have begun to look at our additional needs in the communities, particularly those with our children and the impacts of remote learning across our school system. We've begun to frame out new programmatic opportunities that can support this issue, but that will be an investment that will require, you know, several millions of dollars. Perhaps our most disturbing issue on the cost side of this discussion is one that you all are familiar with, and that has to do with our workforce. As many of you know, over the past several years, our association has reported on workforce-related concerns and measured those on a monthly basis in a detailed report that we share with the Department of Health and Human Services. To respond to increasing needs and workforce shortages, we continue to invest in our people and our teams across all credentials of clinical support for mental health. And since March of 2019, we increased our system capacity by 118 positions, predominantly in clinical areas. As centers make these investments in workforce, you subsequently expect increases in revenue to support those positions. And this is true in a normal run rate outside the pandemic. Additionally, centers have applied to the payroll protection program. However, only three centers were approved in the first round. It should also be noted that the payroll protection program excludes two of our center members, Northern Human Services and Community Partners in Dover, both with combined mental health and DD agencies that employ more than 500 people, so they don't make the threshold for payroll protection program. And despite the payroll protection program, however, that may offer some relief for the all but those two centers, but it doesn't address the recent growth in workforce. The payroll protection program aggregates payroll costs over a 12-month period, so by definition, it won't address recent workforce improvements. In our system, we've added 23 positions since January 1st. The pandemic and emergency order arrived in March, and we still have ongoing costs for these individuals while traditional revenue to offset their costs are on the decline. While we don't want to go backwards and lose key personnel during this pandemic, we've worked hard to acquire this workforce to improve access and reinforce key programs like mobile crisis or assertive community treatment programs that are part of our community mental health agreement. While credential of provider varies in the costs equation of this, if you assume an average cost of this added workforce, including electronic medical record licenses, a full array of benefits and salary, we estimate about $200,000 a position. That's $4.6 million per year on these 23 positions, or 2.2 for 6 months. So all told, existing technology, a PPU program development, and added workforce costs, our system of 10 mental health centers at a minimum will incur another $6.3 million of additional costs over a six-month period. And this excludes the payroll protection issues related to Northern Human Services and Community Partners. So as this advisory board reviews the needs across our state, please consider this presentation that the 10 mental health centers members of our association will see a loss of revenue of approximately $18 million over 6 months. At the same time, they experienced $6.3 million of additional costs during that same time period. Our system of care serving New Hampshire's most vulnerable citizens will basically need about $24,300,000 in order to continue to deliver on its promise to provide exceptional care for those with mental health needs and not harm our system as a result of this pandemic. So I'm going to stop there. I'm happy to answer questions. I can provide any detailed backup. I know this is sometimes very, very hard to do over the phone, but I do appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today and appreciate your consideration in this discussion. So let me turn it back to you. I guess it's you, Jerry.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions for Roland? Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a question? You may have to hit 5-star, Senator, or unmute your line.
Am I in good shape?
You're fine. We hear you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Roland, you gave me two very interesting numbers. You say the aggregate revenue loss will be in the $18 million category. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's about a little under $3 million per month, and we're estimating that to be about a six-month rate, you know, assuming we can get back to some normal state, you know, in the next few months.
Okay, and you said that you've expended about, or you will have expended about $24 million costs in place for the improvements that have been made? Kind of, let me see,
yeah,
or give me a correct number with relation to that.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry if I was confusing about that. So on the revenue side, we're going to see about an $18 million loss over 6 months. On the cost side, you know, we're trying to estimate some new programmatic costs that we have to do, but we think that somewhere in the vicinity of $6.3 million in costs over the next 6 months. And so the total of those two numbers is where I came up with my $24,300,000.
So the 24.3 includes the two things, the 6.3 in costs and the $18 million in lost revenue.
Correct, yes.
Great. I just wanted to clear that up. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Representative Wallner, do you have a question for us?
Well, I think Senator D'Alessandro just sort of asked the same question. I wanted to know if have so much email that I did not see that. Did you send us a presentation or information about the financial situation? If not, could email us something.
Yes, this is Roland. I could do that. I didn't know the format for this, as we're all trying to learn.
Okay.
How would you like that? Would you just sort of like a script of what I just said, or would you like a PowerPoint, or is there a tool that's most useful for the group?
A summary of the financial issues that you just outlined would be good for me.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Lammy, if you would like to send that to my attention at the Gopher office, we will post it on the website. That's gerald.h.little@gopher.nh.gov. So if you send that to my attention, we'll make sure that it gets on to the website for everybody, and we'll also distribute it to the advisory committee. I would just, if you don't mind, sir, I'd like to ask one question just to clarify for myself. The $6.3 million in additional costs, those costs are all attributable to the COVID-19 crisis?
Yes, it's frankly probably a little light given that I didn't include anything dealing with the two centers that I spoke about that can't do payroll protection because of their size. But it includes technology. It includes additional costs in PPE. It includes recent workforce that we've added for which we can't recover costs and are not part or won't be calculated in the payroll protection. And it assumes an amount of money to collaborate on a program to deal with what we think is an emerging issue with respect to our students, our children, and their families in the school systems.
Thank you, sir. And
you're
just welcome. A reminder for the members of the advisory committee, if you have questions, please let us know. We're glad to have you ask them. I do have one follow-up. I believe you mentioned at the beginning of your comments, Mr. Lammy, that this was exclusive of essentially sole providers and SUD operations. Is that correct?
Right. This analysis is only relative to the state's 10 designated community mental health centers. There's also a network of, our centers provide substitute services, but there's also a network of independent mental health practitioners and substance use providers that I don't address in this, and I just wanted to make sure that I'm not minimizing their concerns and the issues that they're going through as part of this system of care as well.
Do you have any gut sense of how they've been impacted by this?
Well, my gut sense would tell me that it's really hard to be an independent practitioner with closed doors and a lack of ability to invest in technology to do things like telehealth and Zoom meetings and those kinds of things. And so, I at the risk of being dramatic, I think this potentially could be the end of independent practitioner care on many levels of providers. So I have to believe that they are struggling considerably.
Thank you. One last call for questions for the folks from the Seacoast Mental Health Center and the Community Behavioral Health Association. Hearing none, if Deborah Ritchie is on the phone with us, are you with us, Deborah?
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
So our next presentation this afternoon is from Deborah Ritchie, and Deborah is with the Granite State Independent Living Group. And I think we received a presentation from you just about 15, 20 minutes ago. Deborah, is that correct?
Yes, you should have something.
So that's gone out to members of the committee. If you want to check your machines, you probably have a copy of her presentation. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hi. So thank you for the invitation. I want to just give a two-minute overview of who GSIL is. I think most of the committee members do know who Granite State Independent Living is, but I just wanted to refresh people's memory. So we are a statewide organization. We are the only independent living center in New Hampshire, and we promote quality of life with independence for people with disabilities and seniors through the IL components of advocacy, information, education, support, and transition services. So we currently, throughout the state, have 1,800 active consumers, and that's through 20 different programs that we have. And many of our programs are well-established that most people know about, which is the in-home supports. Those are all of our PCA services, our personal care attendance services. We do that with state Medicaid and also the three MCOs. Nursing home transitioning folks out of the nursing home, and then caregiver supports. Then our transition services are programs like the Earn and Learn program, the Impact program, which are students at risk that we work with local high schools. And then here are some of the less known things that we do, but equally important is job placement, employment services, disability benefits, community day supports, and staffing services. And then the home modifications, transportation, peer support, and advocacy. So we really do a lot of things. Some are more notable than others just by virtue of the number of people in each program. And I just wanted to list our community funding partners so people have an idea of how we're funded. We are a $20 million organization, and roughly $15 million of that is from the New Hampshire Medicaid program, which includes the three MCOs. The rest... there's a little over $3 million that's from grants, and that's state, federal, and private grants. And most of those grants are what run the independent living services. So they're not necessarily fee-for-service like personal care services. And then we work with waivered programs, the DD waiver and the CFI waiver and in-home supports. So we're one of those organizations that have many, many community partners that we work with to ensure those living with a disability are living as independently as possible in their own home. I want to talk about the consumers. You know, this is our potential impact by COVID, and it's on slide 3. And it kind of just shows you our distribution of where our consumers are throughout the state. And as you can see, while we have a lot in COAS, our two biggest ones are Hillsborough and Grafton, which is pretty surprising. But the Hillsborough one obviously is where we've seen a lot of the COVID issues happening. The gray indicates the in-home support. So those are the folks that are on our PCA program, our personal care attendant program. And then the red are all the student transition programs. So those are the impact and the earn and learn. And I put them on here because this is impacting those kids and their learning. The reason they come to us is to have an alternate learning experience and earn high school credits. And they're not really, you know, in my opinion, benefiting from the entire program because they're learning remotely. So I do look at those folks, just importantly, as say those that have PCA services that have a workforce issue. And we'll talk about that. Then we have, you know, roughly 15 consumers that have day programs through the DD waiver system that we work with. And they're across the whole state. So to denote them in a particular county, you wouldn't have been able to recognize it. So our biggest impact of COVID is the in-home support. So the personal care attendants that are in the home taking care of our consumers. And I've done a couple of charts here just so you can see the growth. I actually started graphing this back in March, and I figured I'd just put the last 4 weeks on it. And the gray represents the total number of personal care attendants not working. And if you look at April 24th, there's 101 not working out of 700. In the consumers without a PCA, there's 115 out of 688. So roughly 14% of our workforce is on unemployment, and much like the health centers, it's for a variety of reasons. You know, it could be that they were quarantined, they have children at home, their consumers don't want them in the house because they are afraid that they themselves will get sick. They self-quarantine themselves because they're afraid they're going to get sick. So it's a variety of reasons. But one of the notable things that is not a reason is due to COVID. We have only had two cases of our 700 attendant care employees. We've only had two reportable COVID positive tests, which is phenomenal for what we do because we are in the homes of 688 people every day. Those two folks are attendant care employees that only see one person, so that consumer has been quarantined, and they've passed their two-week quarantine period, and they're fine. So something's happening that's right, and I contribute a lot of it to how the state is functioning right now. But ultimately, 17% of our consumers are without a worker in the home. So so we have folks that are paraplegics and quadriplegics, and those are folks that are high risk for us because some of them might be on vents already that they use at night. Some are unable to get out of bed, unable to do activities of daily living. And when we start to talk about the number of consumers without somebody in their home, you know, the number gets pretty high because we then also start to think about other folks that are not in their home. So it's just not GSIL in their home. It might be a VNA that's no longer in their home. It might be Meals on Wheels that is now delivering every 2 weeks. So there are a fewer number of people in the home. And I love the mental health presentation, so thank you, because our population is going to see that increased need from social isolation. So those are things that we're now starting to look at, is how do we help move the needle on making sure people have access to telephonic services if they need it, because we're not in the home. So not being in the home, what we're doing is, you know, we make probably four times as many phone calls a day than we had in the past because we were previously out in the community. I will be actually sending my staff. So we have what we call corporate coordinators. They're nurses. that have not been out into the homes to do assessments, predominantly due to the fact that when this first started, we had zero PPE. And I didn't feel safe sending out my staff members without anything. But we've been able to secure some PPE, and I'm actually sending my folks back out on May 4th because I'm worried now about the fact that nobody's in these homes, the fact that Adult Protective Service referrals are down 27% as of last week. You know, as a mandated reporter, lots of those referrals came from my staff, whether it was, you know, somebody was either abused or someone was neglected, things that we would see when we were in the home. So starting next week, we'll be back out doing those visits, and we're starting with the high-risk folks that don't have anybody in their home. Even though we're calling them a couple times a week, you can't see the home. You know, you can't see if there's food in the cupboard. You can't see if the person looks like they've gotten out of bed and, you know, have some good hygiene. So this is something that we're going to start doing, begrudgingly to some of my staff, but I still think it's the right thing that we need to do. So the other thing is, you know, talking about unemployment. So like the Dover Mental Health Center, we're not eligible for the Paycheck Protection Plan because we have over 500 employees. So we roughly have 23% of our workforce who has applied for unemployment. And that unemployment is a couple different things because you'll see, well, why don't the numbers match? The numbers don't match because some people are applying for unemployment, not because they're totally out of their job, but because maybe they saw two or three different consumers and they're only seeing one consumer now, so now they're going to apply for unemployment to help fill the gap. So that's why the numbers look different, is because it's not a one-to-one ratio. We oftentimes have attendant care employees, and you can see that from slide four when you look at 101 versus 115 consumers and attendant care employees. So the nice kind of trend is is on slide six, which is the return to work, because we are seeing some folks return to work, and some of it may be due to the stipend. However, I think some of it's also due to the fact that folks that were out early on have completed their quarantine or have become a little bit more tolerable of wanting people back in their homes, because maybe they're feeling like, I need somebody back in my home, so I want my attendant care worker to come back. So we haven't really been able to say exactly what it is. I think what the stipend will do will encourage people to stay working, even if they're only working part-time, so that they'll be eligible for that benefit. So that, to me, last week when I reported that number, was great to see that we, you know, we do have return to work, which is great. So roughly, GSIL has spent about a little over $15,000 on PPE. We didn't have a lot of PPE because the programs that our consumers are on, they actually get it through their benefit. So historically, consumers would just order their own products when they needed them. And given they haven't been able to get PPE, we've been providing that and paying for that as something we historically wouldn't be paying for. And we, you know, I listed on this page because I have to just thank all these community partners who we never would have used before, because we just need to make sure that they're getting recognized for having product for us to be able to buy. So I put this out there so that when we do get back to normal, we can start using some of these folks and giving back to them. So I'll stop there and see if anybody has any questions.
Are there any questions from the committee for Deborah? Senator Susie, do you have a question for us? Senator Suski, we have your hand is up. Signal here. No? Any questions for the Granite State Independent Living Foundation? Hearing none, thank you very much, Deborah. We really appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Our next presentation is by Gina Balkas, President and CEO, and Gina's going to speak to us about Home Care, Hospice, and Palliative Care Alliance of New Hampshire. How are you, Gina?
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chairman Little and members of the Legislative Advisory Board. I'm Gina Balkas, and I'm the CEO of the Home Care, Hospice, and Palliative Care Alliance of New Hampshire and its advocacy affiliate, the Granite State Home Health and Hospice Association. I want to thank you for inviting me to share how this pandemic has affected our association's members and, most importantly, the people they serve. So our organization represents 38 home care and hospice agencies and 4 hospital-based palliative care programs throughout the state. And our members range from small, privately owned agencies, some with less than 20 employees, to locally owned franchises of national companies, from visiting nurse associations that have been in existence for over 100 years, to Medicaid-only entities with over 500 employees. So we really have a very broad spectrum of types of agencies. Most of our members provide skilled nursing and therapy care to help people recover from illness or injury and prevent hospital admissions. Our hospice members help patients and families approach the end of life, and they provide symptom management, spiritual care, and bereavement support. Several of our members specialize in the Choices for Independence Personal Care Services program to help people live independently at home. So I think that, as you can see from the kind of care we provide, home care and hospice workers really are on the front line, assuring that New Hampshire's most vulnerable citizens receive the care they need. You may not see them unless you have a family or loved one receiving care, but they're out there. So let me tell you a little bit about the impact of COVID-19 on services. Home care and hospice agencies are fully operational and have not reduced the availability of services at all. Despite that, home care agencies are reporting a dramatic decline in referrals from hospitals and physicians. And that's really due to, you know, what you've heard from hospitals and physicians, that there's been a decrease in hospital discharges, physician office visits, and surgical procedures. So there definitely is a trickle-down effect. In addition, as Ms. Ritzy said, patients and families are declining care for fear of people entering their homes. And as a result, most agencies have reported that revenues declined by 20% to 30% over the past month. So the decrease in home care visits is a concern, not just financially, but especially for our patients. We generally serve high-risk older patients with chronic illness like diabetes and COPD, congestive heart failure. Lack of nursing and therapy care may result in worsening health conditions for them. And then on the personal care side in CFI, lack of personal care may in fact evolve into self-neglect. Many agencies are staying connected with patients through telehealth, but not all agencies have audio-video telehealth units that allow nurses to assess patients. We do also stay connected telephonically. The governor's executive order that requires telehealth reimbursements for Medicaid and commercial payers is helpful. But unfortunately, Medicare, which is our largest payer, does not reimburse home care agencies for telehealth services. I might want to point out, though, that agencies are providing telehealth nevertheless. On the hospice side, hospice agencies have reported increasing caseloads, and I think this is a sad impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Hospices often provide end-of-life care in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. I think a lot of people don't realize that. So we are working with our long-term care partners to limit the number of hospice workers who enter facilities following CDC and CMS and Department of Public Health guidelines. So right now, hospice care in those facilities is generally limited to nursing visits, and chaplains and social workers are working via telehealth. In order to help gauge the situation for our members, we've begun a twice-weekly capacity survey of our member agencies. And on April 23rd and 24th, which was the last report, I have more reports coming in today, but as of late last week, 17 agencies reported they had capacity within the next 72 hours to admit 330 home care patients and 131 hospice patients. There were 37 COVID-19 patients receiving home care and 29 COVID patients receiving hospice care at home. I'd like to talk a little bit about challenges in providing care. So protecting our staff is of utmost importance so that the virus is not inadvertently spread from house to house or patient to patient. As others have said, PPE is a major challenge and cost. And while agencies have received some supplies from the state ESU, most of my agency CEOs and CFOs have told me that the search for PPE has been an all-consuming task for them. Just this past week, most of the member agencies did report that their PPE stock had improved, but that was for now. They really never know what their burn rate is going to be because their census could change on a daily basis. Mask inventory is generally good, but gowns and gloves are in high demand. As other providers have said, staffing is a major concern. We had staffing shortages prior to this pandemic, especially in lower wage positions like licensed nursing assistants and personal care service providers. Some workers are fearful, others are at home caring for children, and some are older and at high risk themselves. And because agencies are not operating in a normal way, our daily staffing needs are just completely unpredictable. So agencies are doing their best to keep workers whole by paying them even if their hours have been cut when they can. I'd also like to point out, as my colleagues from the mental health community stated, that the mental health of employees is equally important. And so hospice agencies have redeployed their social workers and chaplains to help staff cope with the fear and uncertainty of today's environment. I'd like to speak a little bit about sources of funding. So home care and hospice agencies are availing themselves of emergency funding sources to make ends meet. On the federal side, nearly all qualify for the Paycheck Protection Program, although there are several large agencies that have been unable to tap that resource. Medicare-certified agencies received CARES Act provider relief payments, as did hospitals and other Medicare providers. And the agencies may also apply for accelerated and advanced Medicare payments, which must be paid back to the federal government. But this morning, CMS did announce that they were suspending the Medicare accelerated payment program, and any applications that are pending will also be suspended. So I'm really not sure what the status of that will be going forward. On the state side, four member agencies received grants totaling $145,000 from the COVID-19 Emergency Healthcare System Relief Fund. And I would say that agencies greatly appreciate the Long-Term Care Stabilization Fund for Medicaid and CFI providers. You know, we are definitely seeing staff flight. I had a call today from one agency CEO that said he had a lot of staff who simply were calling out due to, quote-unquote, COVID-19-related circumstances, generally to take advantage of the federal unemployment assistance. So we are hopeful that the $300 and $150 weekly stipends to supplement pay for frontline workers will help agencies retain some personnel. But it is important to know that the stipends are considered wages. So agencies must cover the increased cost of payroll taxes, workers' comp, and any wage-based benefits. And the current Medicaid and CFI rates, as you know, do not cover the normal costs of delivering care or of this much-needed stipend. So how can the state help? Well, first, we think it's really important that this committee and the other state task forces working on through this pandemic crisis understand that home care and hospice agencies are an integral part of the healthcare system. We can definitely alleviate the burden on hospitals and nursing homes by providing care at home, where, to be honest, high-risk patients are safer. Second, home care and hospice agencies should be a high priority for PPE. This is critical as our nurses, therapists, and caregivers venture into homes where there are no controls on visitors or infection control compliance by the family. We just have no way of knowing when a nurse or a therapist enters the home, what the situation is there in terms of who may be infected or under investigation or who's following social distancing or masking or not. Thirdly, the Medicaid and Choices for Independence provider networks really do need to be further supported financially. And I know as we get further along in the year, the state's budget will be under enormous strain. But I'm asking you, please do not eliminate the 3.1% rate increase set for January 1, 2021. That rate increase, the agencies have budgeted for that. They were planning on receiving that, and it would be very hard for them to absorb the losses they're absorbing and not have that rate increase. But as you consider how to use federal COVID-19 funds, I would ask that you enhance payments for Medicaid and CFI providers, either through an emergency rate increase or special operating grants. You've heard a lot today about telehealth. Funding for telehealth would be an incredible help because it would help us assure the well-being of our vulnerable citizens, especially in those rural areas of the state, as agencies enter a new normal. So, and then lastly, it's important to know that unlike Medicare-certified providers, agencies that are predominantly or solely Medicaid or CFI have received little or nothing from the federal government to help them purchase PPE, keep staff whole, or cover operating costs. So you heard Ms. Ritzy mention that her agency was not eligible for the Payroll Protection Program. Another large CFI provider is Accentra in home care. They have 450 CFI clients. They have 330 employees just in their home care division, but they have other employees in other Accentra units. So they are over the 500 employee threshold. So they are not able to participate in that program. I really do worry most about the CFI program. As you know, the CFI provider network was unstable before COVID-19. So if agencies close or disenroll from CFI, their clients will need nursing home care. Their clients are eligible for Medicaid nursing home care, and that will put even more strain on the state's healthcare system. In closing, on behalf of home care and hospice agencies throughout the state, I want to thank you for listening to our concerns. Our members remain steadfast in their commitment to care for people in their homes from birth through end of life. We will continue to collaborate with hospitals, physicians, long-term care facilities, and the Department of Health and Human Services during these uncertain times. And please let me know if this advisory board requires any additional information. And thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Gina. And I understand that Deborah Ritchie is still with us as well. Senator Sousa, I think we might have lost you back there. If you still have your question for Deborah Ritchie, or if anyone has any additional questions or questions to begin with for Gina Balkas, please let us know. Senator Sousa, do you still have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you so much. Technology sometimes is a challenge in the way of trying to get things done. My question was regarding PPE for patients or clients in particular. I wanted to know if there's been any interruption in the stream of clients being able to get the PPE that they need. And then also, if there are any of the clients that were doing any work themselves that they're now no longer able to do since the pandemic.
So presumably that's for myself, Deborah, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So yeah, folks that were under that are under the PCA program, the state Medicaid plan, or CFI, the Consumer Directed Program, they were required to provide any DME, if you will, such as gloves, masks, anything that they felt they needed in their home. So keeping in mind that a lot of our folks, we do activities of daily living, so we are touching consumers. And so they were always able to just get it through their prescription that they have from their provider and then order it from wherever they were getting it. Some were getting it from hospitals, DME companies, and that has all but stopped for them because we're now doing it and we're buying in bulk in mass quantities because our consumers are calling or ordering it and they're hearing, okay, we'll send it to you in 2 months. So to mitigate the risk for everybody, we, as an organization, have been buying that product for them and for providing it to them. So when we, you know, we have people that go out that just deliver PPE to our consumers. So they'll call us and say, hey, I'm out of masks or I'm out of gloves. Or the one case where there was a positive COVID on the attending care employee, the next person that we put in there, they wanted that person gowned. And but for the product we got from the state, we got gowns from the state. We only have 30 of them left. So we are providing that because they're unable to get the product themselves.
Thank you.
Yeah, hopefully that answers that one. And then, the second question was around doing things that they historically were able to do and now they can't. Do I understand that correctly?
Right. Were they able to do some things either from home, work-type things that they have not been able to do as a result of pandemic?
Yeah, no. So all of our if I'm understanding correctly, all of our attending care employees are out in the home. And there are some
clients.
Oh, the client. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. You know, they're not going out anymore. You know, they're staying in home. So there were some clients that we would take out on transportation that are no longer going out. They're definitely home isolating. But there isn't a lot of it's more of a social thing that they're not doing. Their care is still being taken care of unless they've opted not to have us in the home. When we call them, we'll say, okay, do you have family members there that are helping you get out of bed? Do you have, you know, friends that can bring you food? We've also been delivering food to people, going to a pantry and delivering food because we know they have nobody. So there are some things that worry me, to be honest with you, because I don't think people tell you, I think people tell you what they want you to hear versus what reality is.
Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Hinch, do you have a question, sir?
I do. Thank you, Jerry. This question is for Gina. Gina, as I was taking notes, I thought I heard you say that there was a program that was suspended today by someone for some reason. And so my question is, can you elaborate on that? Was that a federal program, a state program, and who suspended it?
Thank you for the question. It was a federal program that was suspended by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So the program was for accelerated and advanced payments for Medicaid providers. So generally what an agency could do is they could look at what their normal revenue would have been in a month, and they could submit a request for basically that average payment so they could get it in advance. It was a loan. It would be recouped, I believe it had to be recouped over 18 months by the federal government. I think there was a really high demand for it. And so today CMS announced that it was suspending the program in light of the fact that through the CARES Act, the federal government had been making provider grants. I don't know what impact that will have on home care agencies. I know that several of them have applied for those accelerated in advance payments, but that is now on hold.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions for either Deborah Ritchie or Gina Balkas? Seeing or hearing none, thank you both very, very much for your presentations this afternoon. And I understand that our next presentation, folks are on the line. Our next presentation is from Harbor House. Peter Kelleher, are you going to lead this group?
This is Peter Kelleher. Henry Oach, our COO, is going to facilitate this presentation.
Very good. Mr. Oach, go right ahead, please.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon. On behalf of the Partnership for Successful Living and Harbor Homes, we would like to thank you for the opportunity to share what we are doing to support our veterans across the state. As Peter indicated, I am the Chief of Operations. I am also a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and as such, the work that we do to support our veterans really has a special meaning to me. Now, over the course of the following 10 minutes or so, I'll give you a brief summary of the Partnership for Successful Living and our veteran programs, and I will do this through the lens of our response efforts to the COVID-19 pandemic. Harbor Homes has had a long and proud history of providing comprehensive services to the most vulnerable populations in the state. Through our many programs, we provide housing, primary care, and behavioral health services, addiction treatment services, HIV case management, and many other support services. Harbor Homes established the Partnership for Successful Living in 2009 and currently joins three other affiliated agencies to provide integrated care to our clients. We have offices and service sites in 9 cities and towns in New Hampshire. One of our populations of focus has and will continue to be at-risk and homeless veterans. Through our many programs, we provide services to over 450 veterans and their families across the state. We are the largest provider of housing and support services for homeless veterans in New Hampshire. The Partnership for Successful Living has a wide array of programs to support our veterans in need. Our Supportive Services for Veteran Families, or SSVF, is designed to rapidly rehouse veteran families who are experiencing homelessness. Our Homeless Veterans Reintegration Program, or HVRP, supports our veterans by assisting them with employment, search, and placement. We help them with their resumes and identify employment opportunities. Lastly, we have many facilities across New Hampshire that provide veteran-specific transitional and permanent housing. We currently provide housing for 114 veterans. The Partnership for Successful Living was a significant contributor to an effort which led to the elimination of veteran homelessness in Greater Nashua. Our goal is to extend that to the entire state. Our Boulder Point location in Plymouth is a key element to that effort. Now, our pandemic response efforts have been very carefully organized and executed. We're working closely with our community partners to protect the populations that we serve. We have been able to leverage our clinical services to provide guidance and training to our staff. We have increased the intensity of cleaning and sanitation procedures across all of our facilities, and we have also worked closely with the VA to provide education and support to our veterans in those facilities. While the pandemic has presented many challenges, we continue to carry out our work across all programs to support our veterans. As of today, none of our 114 veterans living in our facilities or family members residing with them have been diagnosed with COVID-19. While we are happy to report that, risks are still present, and we will continue to maintain our response posture. Our programs continue to operate, albeit in a modified format. The pandemic has made finding housing a bit more difficult as landlords are more hesitant to show apartments, but we're working through that. We have received support from the CARES Act, which has allowed our SSVF program to use more resources for emergency hotel assistance if needed. We continue to complete intakes into our veteran transitional and permanent housing programs, which is not the case for many of the surrounding states. We also continue to place veterans into employment. And for the month of April, I'm happy to report that we have placed 7 veterans into employment. Now, we're very proud of our response efforts in light of many operational challenges. Our staff have been working hard to maintain safe and welcoming living conditions, and they will continue to do so. Additional maintenance staff hours at all sites will enhance our overall levels of safety. Procurement of PPE remains a challenge, which is consistent across the state. We have been working with landlords on creative solutions to show apartments, such as conducting virtual showings, and we appreciate the support that we have received thus far, whether that is funding from the CARES Act to volunteers making masks for our staff and our residents. So that concludes my my overview. We welcome your questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for the folks from Harbor House? Speaker Sherliff, do you have a question, sir?
I do, Jerry. First of all, I want to thank Harbor House for all that they've done over the many years for New Hampshire's veterans, especially our less fortunate veterans. But I just wondered, for homeless veterans, are you able to find a space for them if they need a place to stay, or is the or are you finding you have to turn veterans away, homeless veterans?
Hi, thank you for the question. So as a result of the CARES Act, we have received additional funding for emergency housing, which allows us to work with hotels and place veterans into hotel rooms while we work through finding permanent housing for them. At this point, we have 4 veterans under that same that fall into that that scenario. So we're very happy that we did receive that additional support from the CARES Act.
That's great to hear. Thank you.
Our next question is from Senator Chuck Morse.
Yes, my question, Jerry, is around the fact that New Hampshire has received some federal funding for homeless. Has his organization received any of that money?
This is Peter Kelleher, Senator Morse. We have not yet received any of that money. We believe it's in the process of sort of being rolled out.
Rolled out or in?
well, being made available, should I say.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions for Harbor House? Not seeing or hearing any. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your presentation. For our final presentation this afternoon, the Legislative Advisory Board last Friday asked for an update from the General Counsel for the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery on the Treasury Department guidance on how CARES Act funds can be used. So with us now this afternoon is our General Counsel, Nancy Smith, who will give you an overview on that Treasury guidance. Nancy.
My name is Nancy Smith. I'm usually with the Department of Justice, but I am here with Gopher now. I think the place to start is very briefly to go over what the CARES Act itself says, then talk about what the Treasury guidance says, and then I thought we would talk about some examples. And leave plenty of time for you to ask questions at the end. So the base is, of course, the statute itself, which sets out three requirements for use of the funds that the governor's office on emergency relief and recovery is tasked with dealing with. And those are, first, that it can only be spent for necessary expenditures incurred due to the COVID public health emergency. Then also, they have to have been incurred, those expenditures have to have been incurred during the period of March 1, 2020 to December 30, 2020. And finally, and this is really mostly just applicable to government, they have to have not been accounted for in the budget that was most recently approved as of March 27, 2020. So that's what the Act itself says, and it charges the Department of Treasury with enforcing the use of the funds restriction. And one thing that is important to note, that the Act itself, as do really all of the provisions appropriating money assigned to the agency, federal agency required to administer those funds, that they recoup any funds that are not properly dispersed. So that's important to keep in mind. Any funds not expended on allowable purposes have to be returned to the federal government. The CARES Act in its entirety, and this section related to these relief funds, which are sometimes referred to as flex funds, doesn't specifically exempt these awards from the general OMB guidance on grant compliance, which is found in 2 CFR 200. So we have to proceed on the assumption that those grant compliance requirements apply to the awards that we make from this money, and require any of the recipients to comply with those compliance requirements. I mean, just for example on that, if a town gets, if the money they receive from this CARES Act package takes them over $750,000 per year in federal funds, they have to have a federal single audit of the year in which they received those money. So that could be something that some of the towns haven't had to do before, but money they receive under the CARES Act may take them over that. So that's just an example on that. So on the Treasury guidance itself that we received, it was, as you are, I'm sure, aware, remarkably short. But it did have some real key points in it that we have to pay attention to. And again, they define necessary expenditures as a way that in regards to public entities, like the state or local government, are for actions taken to respond to the COVID crisis. But for businesses and nonprofits, they can be for expenditures, what they refer to as second order effects of the public health emergency, which can include economic support for business losses or for economic support for employment related losses. And uh, a comforting provision in the guidance is that Treasury is going to use the standard of a reasonable and reasonable judgment of the government official dispersing these funds to determine whether expenditures are necessary. So they're basically using a reasonable person standard to determine if the expenditure was related to the COVID public health emergency. And that's really a pretty lenient standard as far as the government goes. But the provision in the statute are related to, it has to be for costs not accounted in the budget. Treasury has said that that means that for government expenses, for either the state or local government, that it's something that cannot be funded using a line item, or that it is not for an expense that was substantially different from something that was what the line item was originally intended for. And finally, the Treasury guidance comment on what incurred means indicates that the responsible unit of government has to expend the funds to cover costs during the period of March 1st, which is obviously passed, through December 30th, 2020. That would seem to indicate that we have to have all of the funds obligated by December 30th, 2020, but that is an area that we think could use some clarification, and we hope we'll get that, because since we can cover expenses or expenditures made through the end of the year, it would be somewhat difficult to obligate money to cover expenses through the end of the year, simultaneously with trying to get the funds obligated. But one point that the Treasury guidance makes really clear is that for state and local government, one thing we can't use these funds for is government revenue replacement. It's really pretty clear at this point from what they've said so far that covering government shortfalls, such as if taxes are down, is not an allowable use of these funds. So what that means, to go through a few examples, allowable expenditures for business or nonprofit could be grants to businesses or nonprofits for the cost of business interruption. So for businesses and nonprofits, we do have the option of considering revenue replacement, for their lost profits that were caused by the closures. It can be for acquiring protective equipment. It could be for technological investments necessary to do online business or to conduct business remotely. Those are some of the things that we could consider as allowable expenditures for business and nonprofits. It could also be used for individuals or businesses to make up for if they've kept people on the payroll or for employee expenses. And it can be used for unemployment insurance costs that are not otherwise reimbursed. And just to go back, all of these things that we can use these expenditures for have to meet that criteria that they have not also been reimbursed from some other federal pot of money. And so we will have to keep track of what businesses or local government or the state gets from other sources for COVID related relief. So the restrictions on grants or economic support to businesses and nonprofits are really very, very broad. In terms of the restrictions on what we can use some of the funds to support local government are a bit more restrictive. Again, that limit that we can't use it for revenue replacement is significant at this point in time. But we could use it for if, like, the county nursing homes have had additional costs related to the COVID public health emergency. We can use it for those types of costs. We can use it for government payroll expenses if there have been additional costs that they've had to bring people in part-time to respond to the COVID emergency. We can use it for things related to public entities responding, such as food delivery to vulnerable individuals, the support for the schools in doing the remote learning, any uncompensated expenses for additional leave to public employees would be an allowable expense. Additional expenses related to cleaning and maintaining safe workplaces would be additional costs that could be covered. And the final point on allowable expenses is that we could cover things that for local government that are not, that otherwise meet the ACTS criteria, that they're not budgeted and not revenue replacement. And an example of that might be for local government tax anticipation notes, that local government municipalities sometimes need. For example, if they normally need only $1 million in a tax anticipation note, but because of delinquencies in tax payments, they have to get $5 million this year, then the difference, which would like be 80% of what they would have to pay to get that tax note of the borrowing costs and interest, could be covered as an allowable expenditure. But to go back to some things, again, that are not allowable, from what we know now, expenditures that have been reimbursed from any other source, which would include the PPP program from FEMA, CDC, or other sections of the CARES Act. A significant one is also at the moment that we can't make up the state or local match on other federal money, such as FEMA reimbursement. FEMA reimbursement at the moment is still at 75%, and the 25% cannot be made up with other federal funds. I did check with Perry Plummer just before coming in here, and he said that although they are lobbying strenuously to get that changed by either going up to 100% or relaxing the match requirement, it hasn't happened yet. We cannot cover business losses that are not directly related to COVID. So if a business was already having losses, we do have to pay attention to there being a legitimate and rational relationship between the loss and COVID, and not because they were already failing anyway. There's a limit that we can't use the funds for employee bonuses. But that does not prohibit hazard pay. So show for frontline responders that are being given some hazard pay because of what they have to do. That is an allowable expense. We cannot use it for state and local government revenue losses. And we can't use it for losses that occur after the period defined by the statute. So those are the restrictions at the moment. There is the Act does set up a pandemic accountability committee, which its website launched about 2 hours ago. I did find it. It doesn't have a lot more information, but it is made up of the inspector generals of all the agencies that got money. And there might be additional guidance from that source in the future. So that's my summary. It's really pretty straightforward at the moment, but there are some ambiguous areas. Are there questions?
Any questions for Nancy Smith?
I have one. Giovanni, Lou D'Alessandro. Thank you. There are a couple of terms that I'd really like her to amplify if she would. This reasonable judgment, how is reasonable judgment defined, and who makes this reasonable judgment?
It's not defined any further in the guidance, but it's a reasonable person standard that if you can articulate I believe it's a fairly lenient standard, that as long as you can articulate a fact-based argument that the expense is COVID-related, it will withstand scrutiny. It do need some facts to back it up, but it just because it could be argued differently doesn't mean that it's not COVID-related, as long as there is a rational argument that it is.
Okay. So that'll have to test time in terms of how that's interpreted at the federal level. And the other thing was the requirement that an audit be performed if you've received $750,000 or more. Now, is that audit an internal audit or by an outside agent?
It has to be done. It's what's called a single federal audit, and it has to be done by an outside auditor. A lot of large entities that get a lot of money, like the hospitals, already have to do them every year because they receive so much in federal money. But some of the smaller communities that may not exceed that normally this might put them over the top because it's not just the CARES Act money, it's all federal dollars. So if they were getting, $100,000 a year and justice grants before, but now they're getting a whole bunch more in CARES money, it looks at the whole picture of all the federal money. And it's not just government or nonprofits. If there was a large business that they got more than $750,000, that would put them over. So some of the businesses that don't normally get federal funds could also have to meet these requirements. And that's just one example of the compliance requirements that are in 2 CFR 200. There's requirements for documentation. There are requirements for that we will have to build into the applications for not lobbying, not using any of the funds to try and influence legislation, not using the fund, and following anti-discrimination statutes. There are a lot of compliance requirements in 2 CFR 200 that we're going to have to build into the documents that we would require recipients to agree to in order to get these funds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator D'Alessandro. Representative Mary Jane Wallner, do you have a question?
I do, thank you. I do have a couple of questions, actually. We have, New Hampshire has already spent funds on COVID-19. It was, the governor set up a health care fund that I believe has already taken applications and is a grant have been awarded from that. There were a number of other pieces that have happened. And I know that cities and towns have also been involved, as well as I think some other maybe nonprofit agencies, in setting up surge centers. And I'm wondering about the reimbursement of those items that have already been set up and the expenses have already been made. That will those be allowable, and how will that work? Especially, I was wondering about the things that have already been paid for with the state budget, but also those things that, like the surge centers that cities and towns have paid for.
Well, I think the short answer is yes. We could go back and reimburse from this pot of money for expenses back to March 1st, 2020. That's the date set in the CARES Act. So if an expenditure is COVID-related and it occurred from March 20th to December 30th, it will be an allowable expense that we could consider. But for example, the surge centers, those are pretty clearly an allowable cost that FEMA would reimburse. So we do have to consider whether we want to require the FEMA, that require them to apply for FEMA reimbursement. So that we don't draw down. It says FEMA reimbursement doesn't have a cap on it, and it doesn't come out of this pot of money. So if we want to preserve as much of this pot of $1.25 billion as we can, then maybe we do need to consider requiring recipients to have tried to get other available federal funds. And only then reimburse out of this pot of money. So there are multiple pots of money. For example, the payroll protection program, if a business got that, then we can't reimburse for payroll losses. If they didn't get it, then we could. Yeah, there are multiple pots of money that can cover the same thing, but just because a different pot is available doesn't mean that we can't also consider it if an applicant didn't get money from that other source. Does that answer your question?
Partially. So the surge centers, I had heard before that the FEMA money could be used for the surge centers, but I believe that they need a 25% match. And did I just hear you say that this fund could not be used for the 25% match?
That's correct.
So
I understand that there are discussions are being pursued to see if FEMA would increase the FEMA reimbursement. They have done up to 90%. On some other prior disasters. They're trying to talk them into going up to 100%. That hasn't happened yet, but they're also discussing loosening the requirement that the 25% match has to be from non-federal sources. The way it has it'll work here in New Hampshire, is, of course, if it's a state expense, for a disaster, the 25% is the state's, but for local expenses, I believe it's usually split 50-50 between the local government and the state. So the state has covered 12.5% of the local expenses, and the locals have to kick in 12.5%.
Thank you. Thank you. I had one other question about the FEMA funding. How it seems to me that, as I recollect it, FEMA takes quite a long time to do the reimbursement. Do you think is there any provision for speeding up those payments from FEMA?
We talked with Terry Plummer about that, and actually they are working on that. It does normally kind of occur after the fact, but because this is a very long-lasting state of emergency, what they are going to try and do, I understand, is they are currently doing applicant briefings this week. I think the first one started today over at Homeland Security, and with the plan, being that the qualifying applicants, which are government and nonprofits, not private businesses. FEMA can only reimburse government or nonprofits. Will go ahead and put in their eligible expenses for reimbursement up through like the end of the month, this month, so like for the first 2 months of this state of emergency, and then they would try and do them monthly thereafter. So they are working on a process to not hold the FEMA reimbursement until it's all over, which is more the normal disaster process.
Great, thank you. I have one more question, if I can. And this might be maybe more for Mr. Little than for you, Attorney Smith. So I hear on almost all these presentations, people refer to a number of other funding streams, other programs. Sometimes they've gotten funded out of them. Sometimes they haven't. There's all sorts of things. I wonder if we could, for the members of this group, get a list of all, at least as inclusive as we can, of all the other funding streams that there are available out there. I think it's, as we proceed with our work, it will be important for us to understand all these different pots of money that are available and how some of these requests would fit into them.
Yeah,
Jerry,
go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, I think I can speak to that. Mary Jane, we're reviewing a list right now that Senator Shaheen, we asked her for. The Senate President has it, and I think Senator D'Alessandro has it. We went on a conference call on Friday. I think it's a very valuable list for everyone on the committee. I believe it's a public document. I'll find out and I'll make sure that everyone on the committee gets it. I did send it to Jerry about an hour or two ago because I thought it was a great document for the questions you're asking. So.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it. I think we could all benefit from having that list. Thank you.
And the other thing I did ask for, just so you know, your question of last week, I think is needed to be answered at the state level because it'll help with the document that we got from Senator Shaheen to understand where we are. So I think
you.
We need to know where the original $156 million went. So
yes.
I think that'll
thank
work.
You.
Do you have another question, Senator Morse?
Yeah, I have several questions. One, I think I know the answer. If our local municipality, and I'm only doing this because I know the public's on the phone, if our local municipalities do not receive tax revenue, mostly because of businesses, this fund can't be used to replace that money.
That's correct, Senator Morris. At the current time, under the current guidance we have, it pretty clearly says that it can't be used to make up revenue shortfalls. We could cover the interest and cost of getting tax anticipation notes, that it would cost them to carry those loans to cover the revenue shortfall, but we can't make up the revenue itself.
Okay. Let me try it a different way, though. If this is a whole, I know other people are working on other scenarios, but the reality is if we were to supply money to businesses through some organization, I don't know if it's BFA or something else, for businesses that aren't going to be open in this year or some other date that we pick, could they use that money to pay their property taxes? So it helps twofold. The business won't become delinquent, and towns will get their money.
Absolutely, we could encourage. There's actually a state statute that may require businesses that get state money to not be delinquent on taxes. That could be part of what we build into a business. Loans or grants to businesses.
Okay. And then I have one other question as a follow-up to using federal money when you have already received federal money. On unemployment, I wasn't here in 2008, but I believe what ended up happening when we depleted the fund was rates went up 5 times. Can we reimburse our own unemployment fund at all with this money?
So if I could restate the question, because there will be heavy payouts from the unemployment trust account, can we use the CARES Act money to replenish those funds which were paid out that are identifiable only because COVID-19 happened, that we can directly point to dollars that were paid out by the state unemployment fund because of COVID-19? Can we use the CARES Act money to replenish the unemployment fund? Is that correct?
As long as the federal government hasn't otherwise covered those payouts from another source.
Out of 100%, normally I believe the split's 60-40. I think we heard that on another call. I think this year it's 55%, 45%. I think the 45 is the federal government. So if the federal government's already paying into the fund, can we use this to pay into the fund?
As long as it's COVID-related and it hasn't been covered by the federal government for, unemployment under a different section of the act, yes, we could.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Morse. Any further questions for Nancy Smith? Hearing none and seeing none on the screen. Thank you very much, Nancy. Excellent presentation. Appreciate it very much. So that is the end of the agenda for today's conference call. I would just like to restate that we're looking forward to some conversations, maybe beginning next week, as we try to eventually pivot away from accepting testimony on the impacts of COVID-19 to discussions of how you would like to see CARES Act funds used. We had asked on Friday that you give it some thought for several days, and are interested in hearing from those if you'd like to reach out. It looks like, do we have questions, Rhonda? Is there anybody else, is there anyone else from the committee that has another question or two for us before we end today's call? Senator, go ahead.
I put my hand up. I was asking a little different than you're asking it. If committee members have ideas of funding, I started building a document with Josh from the Senate that basically, you know, let's just say hospitals is one of the things that this group wants to fund. So it basically has hospitals, and it has an amount which we're working on right now, you know, with the hospitals. I thought I would have that information back today, but in any case, then it basically would have questions as to, you know, things that legally need to be answered and definitions that need to be put into things. I don't think it's, you know, we can come out today and say we're putting, you know, $10 million in the hospitals. And I'm just saying that because I know they'll get aggravated if I put that number out that small. But in any case, if that's all we're putting into it, how does it go to them? What are the ramifications? You know, they're claiming they have $200 million in losses. I think we need a document to work from that we can have these conversations. So I started building that. I really would like to hear from members, and I probably should get this document out. I need to talk to the Senate president before I put it out, because some of the things that I think some of us thought we needed to fund are getting funded from other buckets, which we wouldn't have known if Senator Shaheen hadn't sent that document. So, but anyways, if members have ideas, it would be nice to put it on a document so we could start this debate that you're asking us to have.
Thank you, Senator Morrison. I appreciate it. Also, in the context of your role as chairman of the Legislative Advisory Committee, the way that was sort of set up was that you would collect those concepts and ideas for us. Thank you. Representative Wallner, do you have a question?
Yes, I guess it's sort of along the same line of what Senator Morris was just talking about. So what I was wondering is, I mean, we've heard from a number of large groups. I mean, like small business, a lot. You know, that's a lot of people fall into the small business bucket. We've heard from the Center for Nonprofits and New Hampshire Charitable talking about the nonprofits, a lot of nonprofits. Is the Gopher office going to really be set up in such a way that it would be set up to give assistance and grants to each individual little business or little nonprofit? Or do we need to be looking at a system where we have like an umbrella and that umbrella agency would then be accepting applications and dispersing the funding. I'm thinking, for instance, I think Mr. Ober from the New Hampshire Charitable brought that kind of an idea to us around nonprofits, local nonprofits. I mean, they may only need very small amounts of money, but it could be many hundreds of applications. So have we thought about what it'll look like, how we will disperse the money to agencies or to businesses?
Jerry, if you don't mind, I'd like to speak to the C. I think that's why we need to build this document, Representative, because I think there's probably enough agencies out there that are much more capable than the state to create these, you know, grants that are going to go out. I say grants because we haven't talked about loans yet. And you know, whether it's New Hampshire Charities, BFA,
CDBG was included on Senator Shaheen's document. I don't know if more money is needed. But I think the best way to work with, I was going to call him Senator Little, Commissioner Little, is for us to suggest that we grab all these agencies that can do it better than we can do it. And I know I have talked with Jerry about this. And so that would be part of the all our team coming up with ideas. I think it's a great idea, to be honest with you, to use those other agencies.
Very well said, Senator.
It could be much more efficient than Jerry's organization trying to do them all, because it could be literally hundreds, if maybe not 1,000 different small grants or medium-sized grants.
Yeah.
Very well said. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think there's as we start to talk about it, I mean, we certainly, I mean, I'm learning. I'm sure every other member is, and that's why a legislative committee asks a lot of questions. I did talk to the other committee, and they're limiting their presentation to, I believe, 11 questions and 15 minutes. We're not good at that. So as we learned about, BFA, and I'll slaughter the agency, what was it, TEMP or something, what they called one of the groups that they, where it's a 20% funding, KEMP was what it was called. You know, I said, boy, it would be genius to turn that 20%, into some number, five or 10 times that number. So I really thought they did a good job on the presentation the other day. Because what could happen, we could be the grant part of it, the 20%, and then banks could come in with the last 80%. That I asked Jerry today, because he's from the banking side of it, wouldn't that make, for companies that can stand up now, not for ones that are going to go down anyways, wouldn't that make a lot of sense, and wouldn't banks look at that favorably? And, I think they probably would. So that's why I think if we put some thought into this, we can expand this money from 1.2 to a lot more. And then I think as we try to solve problems, I think a lot of communities are going to be hurting from non-tax payments. It was just something I was thinking about. But I also heard on the other group that some two or three of them were working on a solution for that. So it may be that we have to talk to them too, but but just a thought. All of this is just a thought, but I do have a document we're working on, and I will get you out what I have from, well, I want to talk to Senator Susie first to make sure I can send that document out, but I thought the document from Jeannie Shaheen was a good document, so.
I'm done. It's raining up here.
Thank you. I need to go outside.
Thank you, Senator Morrison. Thank you, Representative Wallner, very much, both of you. Any further questions?
I do have one more. I'm sorry.
Certainly. Go right ahead, Representative Wallner.
I'm sorry. I'm still a little concerned that we have not heard from the area agencies that serve developmentally disabled individuals. We had the Mental Health Center organization, and we did have Granite State Independent Living, but I would like to hear from the area agencies. I actually had a phone call with one of them the other day, and I think they maybe are having some issues, particularly around payroll. So if we could get them in for 20 minutes, maybe on Friday.
I would be glad to work on that with you, Representative Wallner. If you could send me an email with who you'd like to hear from.
I will.
I'll do my best to get them on the agenda for Friday.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Hearing none, then, the next meeting for the Legislative Advisory Board is going to be on this Wednesday, again at 1 p.m., and you will be getting an updated and confirmed agenda for that meeting very soon, probably this afternoon, I'm thinking. Any other questions? All right.
No.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. Yep. Thank you, Senator.
So thanks a lot, Jerry.
5 minutes of 3. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks, Jerry.